Interrobang.
Hi, welcome back to Interrobang. I'm Dave DeGraw. Today, I'm joined by my buddy Zach. He is a front-end application architect. He's doing some really cutting-edge web application architecture stuff with PGLite being compiled to WebAssembly, storing fully encrypted database backups on the user's behalf. Just really kind of interesting paradigm shifts with a lot of the way we've done a lot of CRUD apps in the past as web developers. We also talked a lot about, you know, kind of the history of JavaScript, what we're currently using with his Vue.js and Vite. I'm more of a web components fanboy. And then we kind of just talked about like the future of application development, really, like what we're doing and how that relates to what's been done in the past. So it was a really fun and engaging conversation for me. I'm really excited to share it with you. So let's dive right in. Welcome back to Interrobang. Today I'm joined by my friend Zach. Zach technically was my boss, I think how we officially met.
I don't know if that's true, but yeah.
We worked together at, technically it was a startup. I was an intern. And now we're just buds. And Zach always has like a lot of really interesting stuff on his mind. You're a little bit like older than me. Not like a lot older than me, but like your kids are kind of one step up from mine. And we're kind of in a similar position, but you're just a couple years farther down the line than I am. So that's why I always like talking to you, get your life advice about, I don't know. Everything.
I don't know if I have much advice to give, but I can definitely talk about it. Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not quite to the, you know, midlife, but creeping up on it real fast. So, yeah, I've got a 15-year-old down to a 7-year-old, 4 kids. So a little bit of experience to draw from, I suppose.
Yeah. See, I'm 4 kids, but we're 10 down to 18 months. So it's like.
Nice.
Yeah. Kind of. That's what you were at probably 10 years ago. I don't know. Well, about
no, not that quite way. That far, but yeah. Yeah. Goes fast. Really fast.
I know, man. It's I was just thinking about it today. It was like, I'm like getting nostalgic about my son playing Fortnite. And it's like I remember like when he first started playing, he got like his first victory royale or whatever. And like, he was so excited, like came to tell me and like, now he doesn't even talk to me anymore. You know, it's just like,
yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's actually like, I was a scout leader, I don't know, quite a few years ago, and it was like 11-year-old kids, and that was a good thing to do, because I think I realized, one, all boys that age are pretty much idiots, so I had a little bit of empathy for when my kids got to that age, because they weren't, you know, they were younger at the time, and then also, just how fast the time goes. Cause from my perspective, those kids just like went off and like left their houses. Like to me, it felt like 1 or 2 years, but you know, teenage years just go fast. And so now that I have kids that are around the age, it's like, man, I better not start counting how many summers they have left in my house or it's going to go, I don't know. All right. We're going to shed some dad tears here, but
I know, dude, my wife is like,
it goes too fast, man.
She's already like counting the summers. It's like, we've got my son and like, he's kind of like on the tail end where it's like, we could start him in kindergarten this year, but like, he also could wait a year and we're trying to have that debate. And she's like, yeah, but like, we only have, you know, like it will only have like 18 years or whatever. And then he's gone or whatever. And I'm just like, I don't know. I don't know if that's a good reason, but dude, it's hard. It's rough when you, I don't know. It's, yeah, you know how that is.
Yeah, our youngest, they switched to all-day kindergarten. Well, actually, for the first year, we had the choice, and that was like an existential crisis. I don't know. We were like, are we bad parents if we send her full day? But, I mean, there's all these things about how, you know, it's better for the kid. Anyway, we ultimately decided to do full-time, and it was perfect for her. I think maybe it's different for different kids. But you know. It's hard to, but I think there's also, I don't know, balance. That's maybe one topic I don't know if I figured out. I mean, even just trying to get this together, right? It's been quite a process with life, but yeah.
That's anybody though. Everybody's, I don't know. It's funny. I heard a quote the other day and I can't remember it, but I remember like on my mission in Kentucky, I was like talking to like a lot of people who like were living on disability, for example, like quantifiably did not have a lot going on in their lives. But they were all super busy. And I realized it's like, yeah, dude, like everybody's busy. Like, everybody has 24 hours in a day, and everybody uses all of them. It's just kind of a factor of, I guess, what you focus on. But balance is hard, man. And, like, the hard part, the hard realization for me is, like, I remember having a conversation with my son. He's like, why is school so long? And it's like, do you want the real answer to that? Like, the real answer to that is because it has to be 8 hours so all the parents can go to their jobs and, like, it's glorified daycare. Now, ideally, it's not that, but if you want to know why school is 8 hours long, that's a pretty good reason. I don't know that there's, like, I don't think any scientist is out here, like, saying that 8-hour school is, like, the optimal. In fact, if anything, the science probably says less school is probably better, right? I don't know. Kind of talking through my hat on that one.
Yeah. I don't know. It's a tough one. I mean, I guess every generation says that about the previous generation. They're like, oh, kids don't know how to work hard. But I don't know. As my kids have gotten older, I do feel school has changed. Like, I remember having a lot of homework after school. I don't know if you remember that. Anyway, my kids, most of it's taken care of at school. But there is a lot of downtime, it seems like, at school. So I don't know. I mean, it's obviously a net win, I think. They seem to be learning and,
But for a kindergartner going to, like, 8-hour school, that's the thing this
week. Yeah, well, I say all day. I mean, it's still shorter than others, but yeah, it, anyway.
Because I think for our kindergarten, I think it straight up is, like, the same. Like, they go on the school bus. I feel like there's no way that can possibly be true, but I think it is. I think they just go, like, they've got 5-year-olds going to school for 8 hours a day, and it's just like... Yeah, as a little boy, like, would that, I don't know. That would be terrible. I went to half-day preschool, I can remember, and I remember hating it.
Yeah.
Or kindergarten.
Yeah, I was like, kindergarten. Oh, yeah, kindergarten, yeah. That's stretching back. But, yeah, I do remember kindergarten. I remember it was half-day or all-day, though. You know, you're just a kid, and you're like, cool. This is where I'm at.
I have a memory of kindergarten because one of the assignments was we had to write on a paper the numbers 1 through 20, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And I, like, just could not do it, dude. Like, I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know the numbers. And I was just sitting there, and they were like, you just have to do it. And I was like, well, I'm screwed. And I remember then I looked up at the clock, and I realized that there were numbers on the clock. But then I only got to 12, and then I didn't know how to do any more after that.
Well, see, that's smart, though. Like, at least you, like, at least recognize that.
Yeah,
that's cool.
Where did you grow up, Zach? Are you from Span?
I grew up in Orem, Utah, till I was, I guess, 18, and then my family moved to Salem, Utah. Then I did the whole mission thing, and then came back. I met my wife, and then we got married, and then we did live in Spring. Well, I guess we lived in Provo for a year, then we moved to Springville, so that's probably where you're remembering the Springville from. But now we're down in Smash Fork. Been here 12 years.
Long time, yeah.
Yeah, I remember that because that's when my kid was born.
So did you go to Orem High?
I went to Timpanogos.
Timpanogos High?
It was a relatively new school at the time. Otherwise, I would have gone to Mountain View based on boundaries. Without Timpanogos.
Is Timpanogos the one that's in Provo?
It's in Orem, but it's closer to, like, WordPerfect and stuff up on the mountain. Yeah.
What's the high school that was, like, kind of up on the hill above where the old Simplify was?
Oh, that's Timp View, yeah. That's
Timp View High School? A totally different thing.
Yeah, well, Timpanogos, yeah. I can see why. Yeah. But that is in Provo.
Timp View High School, that's, like, the rich kids, right?
Yeah. Well, Timpanogos kind of got that too. There was a little bit of, like, the east side and west side of the tracks kind of thing. Like, I was on the west, you know. I mean, since it was next to WordPerfect, I think there were some people that were pretty well off due to that. And I remember hanging out with going to some parties or whatever with other friends, and there were some very large, nice houses. But
that's right. Okay, because I got it confused because the WordPerfect building that was over. You're telling me that's not Provo? That's in
Provo. Oh, I'm sorry. So, yeah, I mean, WordPerfect moved down to Provo. Well, okay, yeah.
Oh, wait, what WordPerfect building? The Novell building? Wait.
The old WordPerfect. Sorry, there's, like, Novell down in East Bay, like in Provo, right? That's probably what you're thinking.
Yeah.
Sorry, they were originally up in Orem, kind of next to the Orem Cemetery, kind of next to the foothills of the mountain, actually.
I guess it's, like, I don't know where business that park. Is.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh, like, down over there, like, the mouth of the canyon? Are you saying, like, one of those...
Yeah, I mean, actually, you know, simplify where we're at. Like if you went up the hill and over to the right, essentially, it's over in that direction. But
that's good memories, man. Because when I worked at Simple File, I had my Trail 90, my Honda Trail 90 that I would commute on. And I would
take, oh, I forgot. I do remember that.
I took a Canyon Road, like from, because we lived in Waimau at the time. So the commute from Waimau to Simple File on a motorcycle in the summertime is like, it was like the best part of my day, dude. Like,
yeah, yeah. Not too long, not too short.
And I just love that area. Like there's that like random, is that, am I saying it right? Canyon Road, right? That's the one that like goes, it's up on the hill above University Parkway, right?
Yeah, I think, yeah, pretty sure.
And there's like, I swear, do you know the movie, The Phone Call, the BYU movie?
Oh, yeah.
Dude, I swear that like the burger restaurant that he works at in that movie, I swear it's
up there on Canyon
Road. Is it? Is that the one?
It is, actually. Yeah, you know, Thad. Do you remember Thad?
Thad? No, I don't think I ever.
I don't. Anyway, he was at Simple File as well. But anyway, he actually grew up like right next to that, and he's like, hey, when we go to lunch, let's go here. And then he said that it's where they filmed The Phone Call.
No way. I knew it.
Yeah, and it's next to Tip View. Yeah.
That's so cool. Legendary reel pull with The Phone Call.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you ate there? You ate at that? Because like I could never tell if it was open.
Yeah, we ate there. I mean, it was good. I don't know. Yeah, kind of the mom and pop shop. That was good.
You should go up there now. I bet you it's like,
yeah, I haven't been there. I mean, that was probably 5+ years ago now, so I don't have to go try it. Maybe it's not there anymore. I don't know. Hopefully COVID didn't kill it or something.
So you grew up in Orem, then I don't even know where Salem is, dude. Freaking witch trials? Like, where is that?
Yeah. It's like up north. It's like between Spanish Fork and Payson off to the right.
Oh, weird.
Is it up in the hills? The east. Yeah, kind of. It's like my wife is from Woodland Hills, which is actually, as the name indicates, up on the hill. There's Elk Ridge that's up there too, but Salem's kind of, yeah. Like if you were driving from Payson to Spanish Fork, not on the freeway, you'd go through Salem.
Weird. Wait, what?
Yeah. I don't know. Geography, man.
So are you saying that Salem is just like one of those random, like along the route, like would you, is it like a distinct city or is it kind of like Springfield?
It is a distinct city, yeah.
Mapleton.
It's its own city. Okay, so it was really small. They have like a pond there and everything. Pacing but
to Spanish Fork, not on the freeway.
Yeah.
But it's east of the freeway. No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. East. I don't know where the Payson Hospital is, but if you were just go past that and keep going northeast, you'd. Anyway, this is what your listeners want to like, dude, just go for Google Maps. But
well, I'm very curious to know, dude. Payson. Oh, yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah. I see. It's just kind of like interesting. Salem Hills High School.
Yeah.
And you're saying Woodland Hills is somewhere. Oh, and so Salem, what's the vibe of Salem like? Is it kind of like Mapleton where it's this like ritzy kind of exclusive enclave thing, or is it more of a small town thing?
I feel like it was more small town, but maybe going more the Mapleton side. I don't know. Yeah, there's probably like most cities, kind of the older part of the city versus the newer development kind of stuff, right? So there's definitely both sides of that, I think. But
yeah, I mean, yeah.
My family doesn't even live there now, so I mean, really? I don't know.
Yeah, because I would be curious, like, even Payson, the amount that has grown in the last 10 years, like, and then I was down in Cedar City recently, and it's like, even Cedar City, not to mention St. George, like, it's just, like, unbelievable, so
I'm kind of curious. The places are blowing up. I was thinking about that the other day, like, I don't know, like, how anybody affords a house these days, like, if I were graduating college again and like getting married, you know, like, I don't know, but they keep building houses and keep filling them. So
have you been in the same house your whole, like you've only owned one home?
Home ownership. Yeah. This one, I mean, that was part of it is when I graduated, it was kind of the opposite market where it was, we bought this house on a short sale and, got it for a really good deal. I don't know. I just remember graduating BYU and been like doing the math, like if I buy a house it might actually be less than rent right now, but I mean I had to wait 6 months and, you know, because it was short sale and stuff, but because of that we bought it such a low price, it's like it's hard to want to move and spend more money. I mean, I guess there's more equity, but I don't know. Once you're in the housing game, you're in the housing game, right? Like, you just have to, if you need to move, you need to move. But
that's crazy. Yeah. Wow. You bought, you probably built a frick load of equity in your house. I mean, obviously it looks really nice, and I'm sure it probably wasn't like that when you bought it. So, but,
We finished the basement. I don't know. This room is okay, but
it looks nice.
Yeah. Thanks.
Wow. So tell me about technical, what do you like to work with these days? Like I know that you were building this like really interesting, what even was it? It was like a decentralized notes app or something where you were using browser storage or something like that.
Yeah. I was really excited about a couple months ago, and actually just got back into it. But, just working on I don't know how to say other than like a shared journaling app. Kind of the genesis of it was that I was using Day One to keep track, like stuff that we did as a family or whatever, but then I'd have a journal for each of my kids and the stuff they say. And it's like, well, if I want to, if we all go on a vacation, I don't want to like copy and paste it four times. Anyway, that's kind of where I started and been playing around with it. But, as far as the tech side of it, it's, kind of fun. I don't know. Native is obviously probably the best way to go, but playing with web technology to make a mobile app. So it's a Vue with Sam's Perfect Stack. Got to put the plug in there. Well, at least portion of it. I'm using Hono on the back end. And I think the cool part was because it's a kind of like journal-esque, and I didn't really want to own people's like private stuff. So I'm using PG Lite. Which is a Postgres database built in Wasm, which is then compiled. Anyway, so you have a full-blown Postgres database in your browser that can be stored in the IndexedDB and store journal entries, and then I just back it up, which is way cheaper than storing people's stuff in a database in the first place. And so the end goal is that they would be able to encrypt it on their side, and I just store the encrypted backup on their side kind of thing. Anyway.
That's really cool. Yeah. So, wow. So how are you currently backing it up? Okay. Sorry.
Yeah. It's kind of a weird paradigm to have a database in your browser, right?
So then from JavaScript, you zip the whole DB up and like send it to your server basically, but it's like encrypted theoretically.
Yeah. I mean, right now I've played with the encryption, but it's just me using it. So I'm not like too worried about it. But, if you were to ever try to scale it to other, for other people to use and stuff, I'd want to do that. But you just literally call Postgres dump and get the zip file or the tar and just back it up. And then you can take that same file and load it up and use it in your browser and do all the same queries that you would. The main reason why there's a lot of potential solutions out there for that. But being able to back it up and encrypt it was one. The local first is nice because then there's no latency, right? Like if it's offline, I mean, the database is on your phone or on your laptop. You don't have to worry about any of the network or offline PWA kind of stuff. I mean, some of that might need to come into play later. But lost my train of thought. I was going to say.
It's all right, man. PG.
Oh, that's the reason why it is, because it's a full blown database. It has, and Postgres is good at full text search. That's why
I
liked it, because then if you want to search for an entry in there, that's difficult to do. Because if I was trying to back it up on my side and then do search, how do you search encrypted data, right? So if you own all of your data on your device and you have a full blown database, if you want to search for something, you're just searching your local database for it, and you don't have to do
that. That's crazy. I wonder how performant is that, because for example, I have an app, I have an app on my website that's a database of every Game Boy game that's was ever made. It's just you can search through and it kind of has type ahead and crap like that. I think I'm storing it as a big JSON blob, which is then downloaded by the browser. And I mean, I don't know. I guess it's probably pretty performant, but I have thousands of records, so I kind of wonder if I went that way and instead of rolling JSON, if I did the, would you call it PG Lite? If I went that route, I don't know. It'd just be kind of fun to play with.
Yeah. I mean, if you just go to, I think it's just pglight.com, or I'd have to look it up.
pglight.io.us.
Yeah. Or pglight.dev, I guess. Anyway, it's pretty cool. I mean, there's MySQLite, which I had looked at, and that's been around for a long time and is awesome. But the thing it lacked, from what I understood as I researched it, was full text search, which for the thing I was building, felt was kind of important. So, but I mean, JSON is great. There's a friend I have a friend that, I mean, he has a big JSON blob and searches it too, and kind of made his own database just out of the, you know, local storage kind of stuff that you can do in the browser. And, you know, I think you're like looking at pglight. I mean, I think each tab can have up to like 2 gigs, at least on the laptop. I don't know what phone's limitations
like a RAM
are.
RAM, I mean, or whatever, of memory.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's a fair amount of memory. Dang, I mean, if you're just, and, you know, computers are fast enough. You know, I mean, our phones that we have right now are, you know, better than the computer I had 5 years ago. So, I don't know, probably is just fine. I'm honestly contemplating, like, maybe I don't even need the database. If I'm just storing text, I mean, maybe I could build it in there and get rid of some of the complexity. And I mean, just because it's a database, you know, it's a zip of a bunch of files and by itself. I mean, I think on disk without adding anything to it, it's like 3 megabytes or whatever, which is, you know, really not that bad. But it is also cool to have like an actual database.
That's just like
database operations. You know, you do relational models. I know, like, WASM is so crazy. I mean, to be able to do WebAssembly and compile like pretty much anything to C and then be able to use it in your browser. I don't know. It's pretty cool.
Like, is like the whole paradigm of like server client architecture. Like, I almost feel like could be completely rethought. And in fact,
yeah,
I feel like you'd probably be better off, because like that is kind of how applications used to be, right? Like, before they were offline, we talk about WordPerfect. I mean, we used to work with the old timers who worked on that kind of crap. Like, we know how that it was done. They were burning floppy disks, right, and having to ship updates over whatever. Like, and I think that, like, you're right. Like, it would be way more responsive. Then theoretically, the application can work without a backend, right? Like, if your backend goes down, like, it's pretty easy to just implement another store of, you know, a zip file, like any S3 compatible layer, like it'd be super easy. So I just feel like, man, that is like way, way freaking interesting to me. And also, furthermore, it's very interesting to me, if we bring the data to the front end, then we can let the front end do a lot of the CPU. Like, I mean, how many companies have you worked for where they were like generating reports? Like, users were like going in, they want to generate a report, and it would just like explode the back end, right? Like, it's gone. Like, you know, your response times just dropped or pinged. I don't even know what the correct response is. I remember I actually had the idea at Simplify. We were discussing a project, and I was like, what if we like ran the query in the browser? So it was a really dumb idea, but I feel like something like this could make it possible. Like, if a user wants to run an expensive query on their data, is their MacBook fan that's going to start spinning up, right? It's very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that's kind of why I was also intrigued, is, yeah, I could put most of it on there. And I mean, the other thing too is, like, I mean, if you go price out database storage, like, just, you know, at 10, I don't know. Like, if you're going to go to DigitalOcean or something and get a database, you know, it's going to be $15 a month or something for a basic database. But if you use like an S3, like one of their buckets, that's $5 a month for 250 gigs. If I'm just storing somebody's, you know, 10 megabyte database of text and their pictures, the cost, you know, I don't know, it's just kind of interesting. I mean, so pglight is actually developed by, I think it's Electric SQL, is that what it is? Yeah, so their whole model is, yeah, use pglight. If you take their full-blown approach, they've made it so that use Electric SQL on your server, and it like works in conjunction with your Postgres database, and it'll handle the syncing between clients' Postgres database, listen to, you know, fire off the events, and then reconcile it and store it on the database, which, you know, for some applications where you actually want, you know, to store people's data and be able to do work on the server with it, that's pretty awesome. I was actually talking to Sam Sieber, actually, but he's using a, what's it, InstantDB, which is a similar model. It's not full on. It's SQL like, but it's not Postgres or my SQLite or anything like that. But anyway, the whole paradigm, it seems like it's getting some traction. Well, like local first, I guess.
How would you handle like multi-user? Like if there wanted to be collaboration, like do you know, that would be a problem, right? Do you have any idea how they solve that?
Yeah. So like electric SQL, like if you had multiple
users. Well, I just mean like for your journaling app, like if you and your wife were like editing the same journal entry or like, is that like the paradigm just wouldn't work for that? Or like what would happen if you
collaboration I mean whether it's client to client or server to client, I mean I think that's just its own problem, right? I mean, you know, Google Doc kind of stuff where you're editing the same stuff, you know, collision. I was looking into that. I wish I could remember, this was 4 months ago, I was looking into it, but there's like a pretty standard model that somebody developed to kind of do that. And I thought I saw something that could even be applied to PG Lite. I could look it up. I should remember, but yeah, I mean, when you have two updates, you kind of have to figure out, you know, is it timestamp? I don't know. That's a whole thing that I haven't really
theoretically, like if you have at that point, you're going to have a backend you could implement like peer to peer, right? Like, that would be crazy. That would be cool. That would be nuts. But say you go to the back end. So the back end, like it would just have to load up the little PG Lite database and look at it and merge it or something. Your back end would probably have to deal with that. That's interesting.
Yeah. For mine, I mean, at least at the outset, it's more like I do it and then I kind of publish it and then somebody would merge it. And anyway, that's kind of my idea with it actually is, a lot of those things, it is like once the service, you know, the company that's behind whatever the app goes away, then it's like my data could also go away. And so I was hoping that if I did this, they more or less own it. And so like if somebody shares something with me, I'm not like linked to their version of it. It's more like I'm copying and pasting it into my database and have my version of it.
Yeah.
And then I could tweak it. And I guess you could make it so that they could, you know, still be linked and like if my wife adds something to it, you know, oh, there's an update to it and it's probably just timestamp based because it's like, it's almost like locked out, like whoever's working on it. But yeah, I mean, that's something I guess I'll burn that bridge when I get there.
You have those exact same problems with any like database application.
Yeah.
Like any, like it doesn't matter. You're going to deal with database lockouts and crazy expensive queries and all the stuff that you deal with. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's not really a solution to that, but that's, I don't know, man, that's rad. And I guess two paradigms, because one is you used to really like GraphQL with Apollo. And one of the things I really liked about that was you could mutate the cache directly. So you could basically like use the cache for your state management, basically like write and read directly. In addition to the excellent built-in caching, it just worked like so well. So when you have all these GraphQL calls going out through Apollo, it's really good at like knowing which ones to hit the cache and like optimizing network performance. So I really like that, where it was just like, it felt like from my perspective, writing the JavaScript, it's like, oh, I'm just writing it. I'm writing a GraphQL mutation. Like, I don't really care where this is going. Right. Like,
oh, it's just
like I have
it's a job like instructions.
Yeah. It's just like, hey, they just updated their name from Dave to David. Like I don't care what you're going to do with that. I'm just writing the mutation. And sometimes it would be just for the cache, and sometimes it would actually need to go to the back end and update something. The other paradigm that I really have been enjoying more recently is Cloudflare workers. They have this idea called a durable object. And it's basically, it's kind of like what you have there with like running your database directly in your browser and having like a single tenant, you know, kind of working on a single database, but they put it on the back end. So they have a worker paired with a SQLite database basically. But it's like, it's just a weird abstraction. Like, and I don't even fully understand it, but like they want the worker and the database to represent the object. So with my durable object, I made like a chat app. So it has like, and I don't know, you can have a D1, you can have an SQLite D1 database paired to a Cloudflare worker without it being a durable object. But I think that the durable object thing, like, it like makes them deploy the worker and the SQL database. Like it's supposed to be like real time communication, in which, I mean, you can with my chat app, it was WebSocket for real time communication. So it's just kind of, I feel like it's a similar paradigm, but on the back end. And I've really, really liked that. It's like, let each little thing just keep its own database. I don't know. I don't really like the microservice architecture, but thinking about it in terms of this, it's just like, I don't know. I like smaller, purpose built. And especially when you talk about like, what do they call that? Tenancy, like letting the user retain control of their own data. You're like, that's super rad. Yeah. Unless they accidentally clear their cookies.
Yeah. That's the only thing that I've been a little bit worried, you know, especially if it's browser based, like you could potentially lose it, but that's why you back it up. And I don't know, I guess there's always risk with that with pretty much any system, if you, but it is maybe a little bit more because it's, you know, not on your servers, you're in less control. But
all right, so do you have to use well, I guess maybe you don't, like, are you using directly like the web file system API stuff to do that, or is it
so they've already built it so that it works with that? I mean, because you pretty much have local storage, IndexedDB, and then I guess PGLite actually talks about it on their website, but there's like open, what is it called?
Sorry, I'm like making you give me like a full.
No, that's good. No, yeah,
this is cool. PGLite.
Oh yeah, so there's in memory, right? You have just the memory of the tab that you're in. And then there's IndexedDB, which is what browsers provide. And there's local storage, but that's really limited. IndexedDB is like the, I don't know, it's supposed to be for this type of thing, like big blobs, big objects that you want to store, like a file system, essentially.
I want to try.
From what I understand, though, like I've never like had to do like the native calls and stuff, but from what I understand, it was kind of designed by committee and not built like super amazing.
Well, I'm seeing where they have like to use the in-memory Postgres versus to persist to the native file system. And they're just doing like new PGLite, and then they just pass in like a path. Like,
yeah. And if you scroll down to the bottom, there's OPF. I guess,
but that's
our origin private file system. Which is
the node part. I'm not looking at the browser part. I see.
Yeah. So you can use it either way.
IndexedDB. I don't even know what that is, man.
Yeah. I mean, if you open up like your dev tools and you go look at your local storage, I mean, there is a place for it. It's a thing, but I've never really needed to reach for it for the applications I've built in the past. But I know there's some limitations and some weirdness with it, but they've abstracted that away from me, thankfully. So
interesting.
I mean, again, I'm talking about like I'm next. I mean, like this is my, you know, nighttime like little project that I, you know, I haven't put like a ton of hours in, so most of it's theory. I mean, I've got something working in my browser, but you know, it's not been battle tested, and you know, I've got like 10 entries in there, so
we'll see how it goes. That's super cool. Yeah, no, I don't know. I just think it's so interesting.
The one thing that I'll throw out there too, that's been kind of, it's just a weird paradigm to have the database on the user's machine, right? So like, how do you handle migrations or schema changes and stuff like that? So I've been using Drizzle. Anyway, I've been able to create the migrations, and it's all JavaScript, which can run front end or back end. I, in the end, able to publish my migrations and then have each client go grab those migrations and run them against their local database. I don't know, it's just kind of a weird.
Really?
Yeah, I don't know.
That's gnarly. Wait.
Oh, yeah, I didn't think about it until I started. I'm like, wait a second, so if I want to add a column and I need that for everybody that's going to use this, you know, how do I tell them to add that to their database?
Because right? Theoretically, obviously you said not right now, but theoretically you don't even, you couldn't migrate their database for them even if you wanted to, because it's encrypted, right? So basically,
yeah, so they have to do it on their side.
So as soon as they log in, you're like, oh, we have migrations to run, and then it would be part of like the initial loading step or something. Yep. Once
it's like literally like the first step of my code right now to check for make sure that we're current. Yeah, it's just kind of a crazy. I don't know.
And you're running Drizzle. How do you write the migrations?
I mean, you write it the same you would for your server. There's just a little bit of, I don't know, I had to do some hunting and some putting together, but anyway, there's a way to basically ultimately export it as a JSON file, and then they consume that, and then Drizzle is able to kind of hydrate it from that and then go run its migrations as if it was running on your server. And so anyway, crazy stuff.
That's super rad.
I don't know. Yeah. As per usual with most projects, you spend more time with the tech and like, oh, what about this? Instead of actually building the thing that you actually cared about in the beginning, right? But I think I finally did that point. I'm like, okay, I think this will cover, check the boxes that I care about and I can make it more real, but we'll see.
Your journaling app, your ultimate journaling app.
Yeah. You know, all the hours I spent on this when I could have been having life experiences that I should have journaled about, but...
So then professionally, are you using Vue as well? What's your tech stack like there?
Yeah, it's not super amazing, but, or I guess revolutionary, I should say. Just Java on the back end, Vue on the front end.
Sounds like you're a Vue fan.
Yeah, I kind of swear. I mean, I was the Angular guy back in the day. Definitely sipped the Kool-Aid on that for a long time. I feel like all the frameworks, though, have kind of converged on some, like, you know, at least the main three or whatever. Like, they're all kind of settling on the same patterns. So I don't know if it matters as much anymore. But I think the main reason we switched to Vue, at least with where I'm at now, and of course, now that I use it, it's just easy to reach for on my side project stuff. But I like that. Okay, I mean, I guess that's the thing is, like, you know, React is on the configuration over convention kind of side of things, Larry. Like you can, at the end of the day, it's just how things get rendered, that sort of stuff. You got Angular, which is convention over configuration, and it can be pretty heavy. And, you know, as long as you follow our way of doing stuff, you'll be good. But if you want to venture outside of that, you're on your own. The main thing that tripped me up with at least Angular, and I probably should give it a fair shake again, was just the build process itself. Kind of a black box, like you're just beholden to however the Angular team wants to do it. And so, you know, with the company stuff, I mean, we'd have 20 minute build times and stuff. I mean, we could obviously optimize some of that, but like to have, you know, when your JavaScript build starts getting longer than your Java build, you start to worry a little bit. So, I mean, that's the thing that's nice about Vue is it's built on, I guess, Vite. Since it's French.
Oh, really? It's not Vite?
Yeah, I looked it up once because I was like, anyway, but I always called it Vite, but anyway.
I don't even know what Vite is, dude. Vite. Like, I know Evan Yu made it, and it feels like he kind of like abandoned Vue for Vite. Like, I feel like Vite has a lot more market adoption than Vue does at this point, right? Like, everybody's using Vite. It seems like Vite's really good.
The way to build stuff now. I mean, it's taken over Webpack and all that sort of stuff from the past, I think.
So it's just like blah, 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 whatever, the same thing but new or whatever, blah, 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 basically.
But that's what I like about, I mean, I guess what I like about Vite / Vite, whatever, anyway, is it's a good balance between, like, I mean, out of the box, you got something that works, it'll build it. And it, you know, does a really good job at it, and it's fast. But ultimately, it's built under or over smaller technologies like Rollup and stuff. So if you need to break out of their conventions, you can like, hey, just let me take care of this. I'm going to write up my thing. But like with Angular, it was like, you really have like a couple of levers you can pull to try to change the build. But it was like feed your TypeScript and then magic comes out the other side. Whereas this one, I can at least understand what's going on in the build. And if I need to get crazy with it, I can.
Yeah.
Anyway,
I guess,
honestly though, I will say like, there's part of me, like I kind of miss the days where you didn't have to build your JavaScript.
That's what I was going to say, man. I don't think you do. I don't think you do.
Yeah, you don't. Like honestly, like Vue 2, like before they came out with Vue 3, I like that. Cause it was like, because all like the nice, you know, I don't know, good developer experience, you know, feels like you're using Angular, React a little bit. Like you have all the stuff you'd expect from a framework like that. But, you know, you literally could just plop a script in your HTML and go to town and it all worked.
Dude, but that's literally what web components are. And I don't understand why people complicate it, because it's like, and maybe the web components I build are just dumb and little. But like when I write a web component, I feel like I'm basically writing a Vue 2 component. And that's what I loved about Vue, about like the single file components. There's just like, you know, common constructor methods. There's hooks. There's lifecycle methods. I've never done like multi web component to another web component, like communication thing. So like, updating state or whatever. I don't know. I think that they can listen and watch for changes. I just never had to do that. But yeah, man, I don't like, that was my question is like, are you, unless you're like having to support some like non-evergreen browser, like you need to transpile your JavaScript or something. Like, I don't understand why anybody uses a JavaScript build system for their front end anymore. It doesn't seem like I don't think we need it.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, I probably need to play around with it more. I think
fellas need it, but
yeah
are that's you on true. TypeScript?
I mean, I am, yeah, both at work and on the side, probably just because I've gotten used to it. And
frick TypeScript, dude. That's all right. A lot of people love TypeScript. Yeah, I'm a Ruby guy, so I never
if it works, it. I like it. I like the fact that like I can use if I need to. I was such a TypeScript hater.
I'm a hater, dude. It's just like, it's just extra crap. Like, if you want to write JavaScript and name your file .ts to feel cool, like, sure, go for it. But nah, dude, I don't know.
Yeah.
That's like what I like about JavaScript. I don't know, man. I write my JavaScript like I write my Ruby. I just really like, I like JavaScript. I don't, yeah.
Anyway. Yeah, I agree. And I probably use, I don't know, I guess I don't, I guess it's maybe one thing that, I guess it's the beauty of JavaScript, right? The fact that you can even just write JavaScript or you can make it in TypeScript. I mean, it's like the one language that like pretty much every developer has to learn.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to do something on the web anyway, right? Like you just have to. And so it's cool that, I don't know, JavaScript by itself is just unique in that people from all sorts of paradigms and languages and backgrounds like kind of are forced to come to this thing. And they're like, oh, this, I like this thing about Python, or I don't know, people, can, yeah. But it's such a flexible language that it can accommodate what you like. So yeah. That's what's kind of cool anyway, but it also makes it for a big mess as to, you know, what the new hotness is and what, I don't know what the community is settling on. I don't, it's always changing. Right. So I don't know, but I mean, TypeScript sometimes is configuring. It's the worst. If it works, then I think it's okay. And it'll catch things, but you know, same thing with my job. Like, I don't know. I got so used to the flexibility over the years that it was hard to do that. But sometimes it's nice to be able to define, like, if I have the interface or the contract between people, like, it is kind of nice to get some of that, like, if I'm going to interface with the back end, like, here's the model, like, here's the shape of the data, and that way we can make sure we're not missing stuff. But still, yeah, I don't know. Yeah, if the scale weighs more in its favor, I don't know, but I agree, though, like web components. I mean, I should look into it again. I guess, you know, at an enterprise level, it was a little bit harder to recommend for a while.
Yeah, for sure.
Because, you know, if you have anything but an evergreen browser or potential for somebody to do it, then you're up creek. And then, I don't know, web components, I mean, I guess you play with them more than I have. I mean, do they handle the main thing that I think all frameworks try to handle is just keeping your DOM in sync with your data or your controller, so to speak? Like, are you just literally writing vanilla JavaScript and updating?
Yeah, dude. I mean, like on my chat app, I'm trying to think, because on the chat app, it's literally like WebSocket on message received, like, you know, find the container element and append a new child element with the text. Like, it's like, and I think that maybe there's like, I don't know, they might do fancy stuff kind of maybe under the hood or have specific APIs to, because I know that like browser like rendering and doing kind of stuff like that is like kind of expensive, at least I feel like I've heard that. But I guess what I'm saying is like, I assume that however web component API standard is doing it is probably decent. So yeah, it's just like,
sounds like you have a web page essentially. It's like, but it's a component.
And like the way that like you do the template, at least the way that I like to do my templates, is I just store it in a template literal. So it's just like, and then you have string and everything in there. And it's just like, it might as well, like, I mean, in Vue, it was like you had your, you know, template tag. And it's like, okay, like if you need some kind of abstraction to like wrap your template literal string in a template tag to make you feel good about, you know, your code, or like, but it's just like, or you can just say const template equals, you know, template. That's how I do it, dude. And so it's like, and then it's up to you. Like, yeah. So you get a new message. It's like, do you need to update more than one thing? Like, do you want to like just delete everything from the DOM and re-render everything? Like, I don't even know how, like, I don't even know what problem that is, or like, I don't know how frameworks handle that or if that's a problem. But for me, it's just like, I don't know, dude, it works great.
Yeah, no, that's a fair. I mean,
like, add child.
I mean, if you have to do like, yeah, I mean, if you're having to do the whole like find element, replace this, and you know, like, I have to.
Well, like, usually you'll like on like, there's like a constructor method. So you'll be like, you know, like, let element equals this dot element, or like, you keep a reference to the tag. I don't know. You can have scope styles. Like, you can, web components can ingest other web components. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of magic. I mean, now that ES 6 or 7 or whatever, you know, support in the browser, and you can do those, you know, the template litter, like, instead of having to like concatenate strings with pluses, you know,
that's what I mean, dude.
Like, it's actually, if you just write a function that says, yeah, hey, this is the
HTML. Well, that's what I mean. Is like, I mean, I don't think you need a transpiler or like a compiler to write modern JavaScript. Like, my baseline is Safari, and Safari is like not even necessarily the best baseline to develop against, but like, famously, there's, you know, and this was a thing in Vue too, like the is thing where you could say like component is this component. It's just like kind of a way to dynamically, I don't know, whatever. There's kind of that feature with web components. Like, theoretically, you could like extend the paragraph element, you know, with your custom paragraph element. And it would be cool because like, if it like, it's a great hint to the browser at fallback content, you know, like, oh, if JavaScript is disabled, oh, it's just a P tag, you know. But if JavaScript is enabled, we can do cool stuff with it. Safari doesn't support that. So, you know, it's not perfect, but I don't know. I just really, and then, yeah, and then consuming it, it's like, here's my script tag, and then my, you know, just render the HTML element, you know, and you can pass in attributes, like, I don't know, however you wanted to do it.
All right, you're convincing me to try it out again. Yeah. I remember like when Web Components first came out, I was like, this is awesome. But then it was
my challenge. Like, I remember you kind of being like a Polymer guy. It seems like, I remember. Is that
I don't know if I remember being okay. I remember talking about it. I don't know. I never.
Polymer really... was like that. That was like the, it was like
that was the
goal or something. I don't even know.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was supposed to be like the jQuery of Web Components, right? Like, hey, browsers are weird, but if you build it with us, it'll work across browser, right? I don't know. Maybe I'm remembering wrong.
A polymer is a substance or material that consists of very large molecules. Oh, polymer library.
I mean, that's half of
Lit's the new polymer. That's the other thing I was going to say, dude, is like, okay. I challenge you to resist Lit. I don't know. I've looked at it very closely. And if you feel compelled to use it, I would love to know why. Because I don't get it. At all.
Yeah, I mean, if the browsers work on the same stuff, then I don't know why you would need it. Like, I could see like the jQuery angle, like, hey, browsers have, well, you know, you write it once and it'll work across the browsers. But if browsers just work, then I don't know.
Yeah, because like, I'm looking at their thing, right? And it's like on the lit.dev, and it's like their demo code. And it's like, why? It's like custom elements. It's like, that's a web component feature. Scope styles, that's a web component feature. Reactive properties, I've never done that in a web component feature natively. I assume it is. Declarative templates are like, lit templates are based on tag template literals. It's like, congratulations, dude. That's like one line of code, bro. Like, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I just don't understand. I feel like it's all just native now. I'm sure that there are use cases for lit. Good news, they're on Blue Sky. That's great.
Oh, okay, but good. Yeah.
I don't know, dude. To me, I've looked at lit so many times, and I'm like, I want to use it. I think it's just like some Google BS that they're trying to ship. Google's good at shipping BS on, like, anyways, I don't want to get too spicy.
Yeah. I haven't played with enough to have like a real opinion or strong opinion, but yeah, it does seem. Yeah, I don't know what benefit it provides in today's world. You know, 3 years ago, maybe, I don't know, maybe, but.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious to hear if you do get the chance to play with web components.
Yeah, again. All right, you convinced me. I'm going to go play around with some web components.
I made a couple now, and yeah, they're all like, that's kind of my preferred tech stack at this point, is native web component combined with a Cloudflare worker. They're both JavaScript. Theoretically, Cloudflare Worker supports WebAssembly as well, but I just like to write it in native. And then the Cloudflare like tooling, you know, for their workers is very good too. Like, cause I know like with Netlify I used to like, and like even Lambda running like JS microservices locally can kind of be weird, you know, when you're developing, but the Cloudflare way is just like super easy. Like they have their Wrangler CLI. So it's just like, I don't know, dude, it just works. It gets out of the way. In fact, if you want to know the honest truth, most of the time when I'm developing my Cloudflare workers, I just push it straight to prod and test there. Like I just NPX Wrangler push, yeah. NPX Wrangler tail, like it'll let you look at the logs, and like it's just so quick and easy to do that. That's so yeah, web components plus JavaScript on the front end, JavaScript on the back end. It feels really good, dude. I really like that stack as much as I love Ruby. And I would love to see Cloudflare bring Ruby support natively to web to workers, but I don't know, man. Maybe I should write my web components in Ruby. I know that there for a while there was like a Ruby to JavaScript transpiler.
Oh yeah. Yeah, transpiling, I don't know. I don't know if I've ever heard anybody say, like, I had a super stellar experience with transpiling. I don't know. But I don't know, there probably is better, there's gotta be better ones than others for sure, but
I wonder if there's like a, is there a language out there that is like specifically meant to be transpiled?
Well, what you need to do, because we just talked about WASM, is just if Ruby's your favorite language, you just write it, have something compile it to C, and then just deliver it to WASM. WASM is just, it doesn't matter what, you know, just, I don't know if it could compile to C or not, but.
I don't know.
I mean, that's what's.
How does that even freaking work, dude? Like, because it has like all these native APIs and stuff, like. How is it possible? Like, that's what I don't understand. It's like, yeah, like I write a C program, you know, like that we used to write in like CS100 where it's like adding 2 + 2. Like, you're going to tell me that I'm going to take that C program and compile to WebAssembly. Like, what is the expected output of that? Like, I guess it would, if you're C out 2 + 2, it's like going to write it to the console. Is that, like, what's the common API? That's what I understand.
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. I think. So,
like, how do you write to the screen?
Rust is the new cool way to write C and stuff, right? I think they have a package that kind of, if you write against that, like, it'll handle, you know, if you do like a, if you want to write out to the console stuff, it'll like handle the discrepancy between. I don't know. I'm no expert on it. I just, you know, benefit from all the other people's hard work. So
yeah, it always feels to me like when it's like, oh, this is compiled with MScript and with WebAssembly, it just feels like black magic. You're just like, I hope this works. Like, I was actually kind of thinking about this, and you're old enough to remember this, but like, you remember like back in the Windows 95 days or whatever, it's like you'd find some like CD with software on it. You'd like put it in your computer and it was like, you double click on the EXE and it was like, maybe it would work. Maybe it wouldn't. Like if it didn't work, it was just like, who knows? Like, and I feel like we even had CDs around the house that like we had for like 10 years and they like never worked. And then one day, like my brother figured out how to get it working. Like, so it was just like, I almost felt like this big black box a little bit. And for some reason, like that was actually kind of fun. Like that's kind of a fun way to consume software for a hobby. But what I was trying to say is whenever I use MScript and stuff, that's what it feels like. It's like, is this going to work? Is it not? Like, I have no clue. I don't know how to fix it. Like, well, and maybe that's part of it. Like, because you can't view the source of WebAssembly, right? Like, it's not JavaScript. Like, so it's like theoretically JavaScript, I can like unminify it and like put a debugger and step through it. But like WebAssembly is just like,
it's a compile target.
Yeah. Like, and if there's a problem with it, like, I'm going to go recompile it. Like, good luck with that, man. So, but at the same time, if it works, you know, you boot up double click Quake or Doom or whatever. And it's like, it just works like so well right off the bat. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty cool. Yeah. CDs and stuff, you make me think about, like, it's like being a web developer for my whole career. Like, it's nice that if I mess up, I can go, you know, push a change to prod and fix something. But it's like, could you imagine like the, I don't know, months of QA or whatever before you like go burn it to a CD-ROM and ship it out to thousands of customers, like, and hope that you didn't mess it up. I don't know.
Just, yeah, man.
Interesting world, but. Actually, I remember, it's kind of funny, like you mentioned, like, earlier when we were talking about PGLI, like, the, you know, the paradigm shift, but it's always that balance, right? Like, it's either on the user's machine or on a server. Like, like, oh, the cloud was like the big thing. It's like, I remember a professor be like, well, like that's like how computers started. You had a terminal that talked to the mainframe, and it was like everything was done on the cloud, if you know, like. And so we like, it's like, oh, cool, now we can ship stuff on CD-ROM and everybody can do it locally and we do all that stuff. And they're like, oh, cool, the World Wide Web's awesome. And then we like go back to web and every, you know, now, you know, it's not a HTML page, it's an application in my browser. I don't know, it's just funny. It's like the same
thing, but different.
Conversation, you know, everything that was figured out with computer science all happened in the 70s, and we're just rediscovering it or reinterpreting it. So,
well, they kind of say that like the web is the ultimate application development platform. It's like it might be like the last application development platform we ever invent. Like, if you think about it, like, do you think Microsoft is going to come out with like some new Windows API to like make cool apps? Like, I mean, they have DirectX for crap for gaming, but like, they're not going to come out with imagine if Microsoft came out with like basically their own version of HTML or whatever, you know, whatever, however.
It's kind of how it was at the beginning, right? Like, you had different browsers with different.
They're like, instead of HTML, you're going to write like MSHL and you're going to use like C# script. And like, it's like, imagine if they tried to pull that off. Like, they can't even make their own browser anymore, let alone. Anyway.
Yeah. I don't know. Honestly, like, I was thinking about that, like, you know, go through school. You talked about some doing web. I almost feel like some of those early classes that are mostly just boot camp to like for the previous generation. This is all the hard stuff we had to do, but you'll never actually do. Like, I don't know if I honestly would have been a programmer if I was born like 10 years earlier and was like having to do anything in assembly or C, you know, like, I don't know. Like, JavaScript was. I mean, I had done some stuff before that, but that was probably really my gateway drug, so to speak, to coding, because it's just so accessible, right? Like, you literally just go take a text file, put .html on the end of it, and you can put a script tag, and it works.
Yeah.
But
it's incredible. Yeah. What early memories of computers do you have, like, growing up? So you sounds like you had them around the house growing up and stuff like that?
Yeah, so my dad worked at Novell, like a lot of, I guess there's only a couple places you could work as a programmer, you know, in the 90s or whatever, at least here in Utah. So we had a computer, and I remember, like, from a pretty early age, I just remember, like, being able to play a couple games on it, or, like, I remember my dad hooking up to the phone line before it was even, like, true internet. Somehow, I think he had some, I mean, I can't remember what it was, but I remember, like, hearing the dial tones and then, like, being able to connect and like play a game remote, like, that just blew my mind. I don't know. It's funny. We didn't have the internet for a long time, but I had a friend whose mom was a congresswoman. And so she had to have the internet, cause, you know, anyway, but I just remember like him showing me, I think like the really early days of Yahoo or something like that. And I was just like, I don't know why that just like resonated. Like, that's so cool. Like, you know, instead of
just what year was it? Help me out. Do you, you know,
I mean, I probably would have been, geez,
95,
97? Yeah, probably around 95-ish, yeah. I mean, she had a ThinkPad. I remember that's what it was. So it could be earlier than that, but...
Wow.
Yeah, but I remember playing MS-DOS games and stuff like that. It was, I don't know. Yeah, I kind of grew, you know, born in the late 80s, so you kind of had both sides of the...
What were your favorite DOS games to play besides Microsoft Movie Maker?
Oh yeah, that's true, dude. I put a lot of hours on that as a kid. That,
it's still sweet. It's still awesome.
Yeah. Actually, I pulled it out the other day with my kid. I guess a couple months ago. I
should say that. Oh yeah, did you end up booting up, like, because it's like fully
open? Yeah, I actually found the CD-ROM, and I had a external. You know, who has a optical drive anymore? I found one in my box of, you know, cords and crud that you think you'll use but seldom ever do. Anyway, I pulled that out, installed it, and was able to get it to work, and my kids actually had a really good time with it. It was fun to make a movie together. Is that technically, I mean, it ran from Windows 95 or whatever, but I guess is it technically MS-DOS?
Because this is kind of where my thoughts are at, right? Because you mentioned it's like, remember the days where you used to have to like burn a CD and like send it to the store? And I feel like, I don't know, look at a program like Excel. Again, I'm going to throw Microsoft under the bus because I will repeatedly, because like Windows 98 was like incredible. I installed Windows 98 for the, I installed a fresh copy of Windows 98 the other day. Going through the entire setup, the boot up process, even in 2025, is incredible. Like, you boot into Windows 95 and it's like playing rock and roll, like, dun, 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 dun. It's like, you're like, dude, this is sweet. Like, I booted up a computer a million times and like no OS experiences. I was watching a YouTube video where a guy was going through it and he was like, Microsoft used to go all hands on deck for their Windows releases. You know, it's like now they have Cortana like trying to sell you Minecraft on boot up, like sign up for our spyware. But
that is true.
Think about a program like Excel, dude. Like there are like we as programmers, you pick up Excel stories, dude, like small countries operating solely off of Excel. I know for a fact that a major auto manufacturer in a certain country operates their inventory system completely off of Google Sheets. Like, but you look at a program like Excel, right? Excel 98, 2000, and at some point they make it a web app. And I literally feel like it's because Excel became so big and so complicated that like you couldn't even, it became impossible to, like a program like Excel, I feel like became too big to even release with like any quality. Like how could you even QA a program like that with all the legacy stuff, like 20 plus a year? Like, so it like, I feel like if they had to take whatever Excel is right now and like burn it on a CD, it has bugs for sure, dude. Like Excel, Microsoft Excel has bugs in it right now online. I feel like as a web developer, I've never shipped something. Maybe they're way better than I am, but I don't think it's true. I don't even know that it's possible. So I guess I kind of feel like that's what I like about that experience of the 90s was like you'd put in Nickelodeon movie, Windows Movie Maker, and it was what it was. Like, and there probably were bugs. Like, dude, if you do this and then this, it'll crash. But yeah, then you just know not to do that. Like, it's okay. Like, it's not the end of the world. You can work around that. But
and now, sometimes that's where the like fun.
Yeah, you learn how to use it now, dude. You freaking boot it up every time, and it's like, oh, take our quick tour for our redesign. It's like, dude, if I ever have to go through another guided walkthrough tour of a web application,
you talk about games, like, I know your kids play games, but dude, that's like a source of frustration. Like,
just buggy games.
I miss the days where you pop the cartridge or the disc in, like you said, the game is the game, it is what it is, and you just play. Like nowadays, it's like my kid doesn't even care about the online stuff.
Yeah, it's but like I have update
to
like set up
all the parental control stuff. Yeah. I have to like, I don't know, it's sign like this EULA. Whole. Oh my goodness! And then also like even playing some games, it's like I wish it would just stay the same. Like I don't know the I guess the freemium model where it's like it's free to play, but we have to peddle our battle passes and our whatever else is.
The most recent Borderlands 2 update literally broke the game, and it was like years ago. Like that's all it did. They like it was like some marketing DRM crap that they like added on top of it, and it's just like if you roll back to the previous version, it works fine. It's like, yeah. I don't know, man.
Honestly, like I mean, even with the newer games, like I'd rather just pay for it to have it like. I don't know.
Nintendo's still the same. Nintendo's pretty
good. Yeah, okay. Quality. Yeah, they keep that mostly the same, I think. I feel like it's pretty stable, which is nice.
With the Switch anymore, it's like you're buying the games online. But truthfully, man, like, I don't know. Like, I feel like if I had a home, if I, like, for a family PC, I would have, like, a Chromebook for, like, web research, and then I would have, like, Windows 98 for, like, gaming and office. Like, even, I like to make greeting cards, and there's, like, I think it's, like, Microsoft Hallmark greeting card maker for Windows 98 or something.
Oh, yeah. There are so many cool, like,
dude, graphs. But, anyway. But here's the thing, dude. Like, okay, yeah, so I like to use that, and then the thing is all the graphics and everything are stored as vectors. So then you can actually export, like, a PDF from Windows 98 and load it up on Mac or whatever, and it's, like, it looks even better. Like it looks so good. And so I don't know. I didn't like, then my daughter saw me doing that one time and she was like, Dad, can I try, you know? And like, I just feel like loading some random Windows 98 machine up with like 20 random programs for my kids to play around with. I think that they would have more fun than a gaming console. A modern.
Yeah. Why is that? The like constraints almost make things better. Like, I don't know. promote more creativity and more, you know, like, because we've all played Minesweeper and whatever else, you know, the pinball game that came with when, like,
you just play it,
like, all, you're like, yeah, this is good enough. I've got some game, you know, yeah, like,
you're like, I don't really, yeah, it's like, I'm kind of bored of everything. I'll fire up Space Cadet, 3D pinball,
even try some solitaire or whatever.
Free, quick round of Doom. And maybe that was part of it too, is like, because they were smaller and more piecemeal, it's like, dude, it's like, hey bro, do you want to like boot up Borderlands really quick? It's like, it would take us 15 minutes to like download the latest thing, to log in. Oh, like we have to do 2FA again. Like, oh, how do we even like, oh, it doesn't even work. I don't know. Like, you can just put Tetris in your Game Boy and turn it on, you know, like that's it. And I feel like we've lost that in a lot of ways that.
Yeah, I mean, I think as time goes on and things, you know, internet makes things more accessible. I mean, I don't know, like even with music, right? Like everything's just so prolific, it's you can't keep up on it all. Like what the coolest game is or what the cool music is anymore. Like, I don't know. I mean, it's also awesome that there's so many options and you can find something, but it's like, honestly, like a lot of these games, like I don't even know what, a lot of it's just got to be a passion project for people, because it's like, who's going to go like, I'm going to go create a game and put it on Steam. I mean, I guess we know somebody that did that, right? Yeah, but like, which is awesome. Like if you love it, but like, I mean, if you're there to like make money or something, it's like,
yeah,
I don't know. Like you got to do it for the love, it seems like, because there's just so many games and so many, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah. It's
like, I don't know why I was saying that. Like, remember the game Myst?
Yeah, dude.
Like that was such a popular game for whatever reason. But like in today's world, it probably would. I mean, even if it was,
I think in today's
world, nobody would care to do.
No, yeah. I posted it in the Ideas channel. I was like, I want to make Myst for kids, like iPad Myst for kids on. Like, give iPad kids Myst for kids. Like Myst sucked. It was hard, but like it was, even as a kid, like Myst was very interesting to like go explore and walk around.
Yeah, I put some hours on as a kid. Just, you know, it's my funny. Dad bought it, right? You know.
Yeah, same story. Watching your dad play, watch your brothers play. I remember being in the nursery leader, you know, at church when we first got married, and there used to be an app on the App Store called Epic Citadel, and it was like a tech demo of the Unreal Engine. You know, at that time, this was like 10, 15 years ago. You know. And all it was, like, it almost kind of looked like Oblivion, but it was just like an empty, like, cathedral medieval town, you know, with like sounds and water. And but there were no people. There's nothing to do. All you did is walk around. But I just remember sitting there with all the kids in the nursery for like 15 minutes, like just walking around, like looking at the city. Like, I absolutely think kids would play Myst, you know, if we made Myst for kids. And honestly, I think you can make Myst for adults, and I think people do make Myst for adults. And frankly, I think you're probably better off, if you want to make a video game, you're probably better off targeting some crazy niche like that than like, oh, that's, I'm going to make a first person shooter. Like the game that I almost bought an original, like a Game Boy Advance game, like somebody, these guys made a new Game Boy Advance game, and it's actually really good. And they charged $20 just for the ROM. And I sat there and thought very hard, like, they put out a demo, and it's a sweet demo. I really want to play the game. It's called Good Boy Galaxy, but I decided I'll just go, I'm playing Mega Man Battle Network 3 because I already owned it. But I don't know. Like, that's what I mean though. It's like, how many people would buy some random game on Steam? But it's like, how many people would buy like a really high quality Game Boy Advance game? How much harder would it be to make a high quality Game Boy Advance game than like a moderate quality Steam game? You know, like, I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, and I guess you're making yourself a bigger fish in a smaller pond. Well,
and then people start buying your Game Boy game, and it's like, it's pretty easy to put a Game Boy game on Steam, you know? But like, if you start, and again, it goes back to your constraints, I think, because if you start with more constraints, right? Like, and maybe this goes back to the web as a platform to develop for. Maybe it goes back to Windows 98. Like, I don't know. I think, I don't know. There's something to be said about innovation, right? And innovation, it happens within constraints. If there were no
constraints. Yeah, I will say, like, I don't know. I think it's just, like, it doesn't matter if it's, you know, coding or music or whatever hobby. I feel like, I don't know. I've, like, you know, we've talked about music and stuff. And when I first got my DAW, I'm like, oh, I got to get this plugin and I've got to get this stuff. And it's, like, it's easy to, like, I don't know. I had this discussion with my kids too. Like, I don't know, with YouTube and everything, it's easy to be like, oh, in order to do, to do this thing, this hobby or this project or whatever. It's like you do all this research and you can like just spend endless time and money, I don't know, buying the stuff or researching this thing you want to do instead of just doing it. And like, you know, like the stuff that's just built into your DAW or whatever, like you could probably make a pretty awesome song with just the dumb instruments that are in there, right? You don't need to go buy any, I don't know. That's maybe a bad example, but right. Same thing with that's code. Like you can just, yeah, it's almost like an excuse. I may have talked about this before, but I feel like sometimes that's just human nature. Like, it's like, I don't know if you've ever used like a budgeting app or a to-dos app or whatever. I feel like it's easy to get enamored with the tool than the thing that the tool is supposed to help you create, I guess. Like you're like, oh, cool. I don't know, put everything in Excel or I use this cool budget app and I did all this stuff. And it's like, cool. Did you save any money? No, I just spent my time pushing stuff around. You know, I didn't actually use the information that it generated. I didn't change my behavior or anything. I felt like I was doing productive. It's almost like a bad substitute for the real thing. But anyway,
it is like, in, I don't know. Cause it is,
I don't
like,
know what I'm saying. Well, it sounds sort of profound, but
no, it is because like, there's something we said about building competency with your tool set, right? It's like, can you hear my kids screaming?
Yeah, maybe a little bit, but that's life, man.
There's something to be said for developing skill set with your tools, right? Like, however, I don't know. I'm thinking about like an electrician using a power drill, right? Like, or
yeah, like, I mean, I think there's a point. It's like money brings happiness to a certain point. Like, there's a certain base level of tools or equipment you need for particular tasks or jobs or hobbies or whatever before.
I don't know though. Maybe it's just like literally just start with literally whatever you have. It doesn't even matter. Like if you don't even have a keyboard, like, and you want to write code, maybe you should just like, and you have a mouse, but you have no keyboard. Maybe you should just like start using a virtual keyboard. Like literally, like it's like, you can do that, you know? And then at some point you're like, dude, using this virtual keyboard like sucks. And then you'll go buy a real keyboard and it'll probably suck worse. Because if you don't know how to type, that's a big skill to develop, right? It'll probably take you forever to learn how to type. But man, if you do, and you already know how to code, like, you know, you've taught yourself how to code using a virtual keyboard, and then like by the time you go get a real keyboard and know how to type, I feel like it probably would be worth the investment. So, but yeah, I definitely know what you're talking about. Cause it's, I think a lot of it might be marketing. Like, it's just like, it's just fun to spend money. And like, you have this,
yeah,
they sell you this
idea. I mean, any hobby, right? Like the reason why I'm a bad golfer is cause I have bad gloves or, yeah, you know, whatever. Like, I don't know. It's just, we all, I don't know. There's some human nature thing there where it's like, it's almost like, we want to be able to have an excuse for why we aren't good at it. We're like, cause it's all that 10,000 hours, right? To be a master or something. Like most of us don't want to put in the time. We look for shortcuts somehow. Like it's, oh, it's the, you know, it's not my guitar ability to play it, it's the guitar itself. So I need to get the cool, you know, I don't know. But then you watch a YouTube video and like you have somebody that's really good at guitar and they take like the $100 one from Amazon and they're doing something beyond anybody that can be played, you know. I don't know.
Yeah, it's I don't know. I just feel like generally speaking, if it's pay to play and if it, and you got to be very conscious, but like if you feel like spending money is going to make you more successful at something, be very suspicious of that. Like, cause very rarely will it have a direct, like even, yeah. Like we use our MacBooks every day, right? Like I know you, and actually I want to ask you this. How are you doing on time, Zach?
Doing okay, but yeah, maybe we should wrap up here in a little bit. Okay, you got screaming kids, it sounds like.
Yeah. I know that you're the type of guy who you have like Logic and Affinity and your code and JetBrains and everything open all at once on your computer. That's why you bought like a specced out machine. And even if you went and bought like a brand new MacBook, you know, that has like 20% more speed, it's like, it's not going to make a difference. Right. Like, even in like on the contrary, dude, like say you had to go back to like your old Intel MacBook with the fan spinning to 11, like you could probably live with that. Right. Like you honestly probably could. Like, anyways, what I want to ask you is, how's Logic Pro going? Did you give up on it?
I've used it.
You're able to.
It's hard though. Cause it's like, I just want to go do the thing. And then, you know, to remap my brain to something else to do the same thing when I can just go do it.
It's so frustrating.
3 seconds in the other one. So it's, I don't know. It's like I keep reaching for it. Maybe there's a sunk cost too, because, you know, I paid for Ableton. And yeah. Anyway, obviously just more proficient with that tool. So I reach for it. But I do like, Ableton's definitely a lot more utilitarian in its look. You know, like Apple makes nice things and Logic looks awesome. And honestly, so like the drums that you did, like, I had a hard time finding something that matched, even with like some of the bot plugins I had. I finally found one that was good enough in Ableton, but like, I mean, it was like, it's a pretty good sounding drum kit that you got just built in there. So anyway, so I like it. Yeah. And I mean, it seems like, I guess, yeah, maybe like good value, like for the price and everything. And the fact that it just works on your Mac and stuff. I don't know. Yeah. Pros and cons to everything, but yeah, I do like it.
But you're an Ableton guy. Yeah, that's fair. And frankly, I
could be converted, but I
don't know. Yeah, like, I guess my perspective is like, you pay for a Mac. You bought a Mac, right? That's actually the only way that you can buy a license for Mac OS, right? It's the only way legally you're allowed to use Mac OS. It's actually also the only legal way that you're allowed to use Safari, and you choose not to use it. It's like, you're paying for Safari, dude.
That's true. Yeah, I do use Safari.
It's like not using the built-in CarPlay in your head unit and like buying like the external one, you know, like it's like,
yeah, that's true. I can
see. Well, I guess the built-in head unit is usually a piece of crap, but I don't feel like Safari is a piece of crap, but I don't know. I feel the same way about Logic. It's like, you're paying, like, you don't have to have a Mac to use Ableton. You're paying for the privilege.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it is with some things that's nice, like the fact that I'm not locked into, you know, if I ever need to switch or like,
why is that, you know, nice? Back when, you just never switch.
Yeah, exactly. You just, I don't know.
Like, what are you going to do? Use, like, honestly, dude, if you had to switch to Windows.
Yeah, I'm never going to switch. I guess one example maybe Linux? Is I built a gaming PC, right? And at the time, I didn't have a good enough Mac to do like video editing. And so at the time I remember this. And so I used DaVinci Resolve to do video editing, which is nice because it's multi, you know, cross platform. And I was able to move my files once I did have, you know, sometimes not being locked in. I don't know. But again, if you have the
$3,000 MacBook, dude, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah. But at the time I didn't. So it was nice that I could like take it over.
I get it. I used to use Android. But I used to use Linux.
I mean, that's a bad example.
You used to use Windows. I don't know. It's just kind of an interesting thing to think about. Like, you are paying for Safari.
Yeah.
I don't know. Well, Zach, I'm going to let you get back to your afternoon. what words of wisdom do you want to share in closing, man?
Oh man, I should have thought about this beforehand. Oh yeah. What words of wisdom have we gleaned from this conversation? Probably, anything?
I've offered nothing. I know that. Well, I'll have to go back through it and listen to what you said, because I'm sure you've shared a lot of stuff that's valuable.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. Let's see. We talked about balance for a second. Everybody struggles with it. We've talked about creativity might bloom with constraints.
Yeah.
Being happy 98. With what you got. Don't make excuses for the... You know, don't blame your equipment or whatever on your abilities. Spend the time. I don't know. Anyway, words of wisdom. Let's see. Stay curious. Look into new things. I don't know. I got nothing, man. There's no... Anybody that's listening is smarter than me, so... Listen to your heart. There you go.
Yeah. I definitely know that that's not true, but man, I really appreciate you spending the time, and it's thanks a lot, Zach. It's been great talking with you.
Yeah, thanks. It's been fun. Yeah.
Interrobang.